This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Ar-Rahman and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat can't make it today. He's overseas for a conference, but we are joined by three interesting guests to talk about privilege across borders. And they're all Americans, and they've been in Malaysia for at least a year, teaching English. Let me just introduce them to you right now. We have Justin Galley, coordinator of this English Teaching Assistant program that's conducted by MACI. Also with us are Sarah Townsend, who's also a coordinator.
Yes, hello.
And Alize Ahmed.
Yes, hi.
And you just finished your teaching term, right?
I did.
Yeah, and where was that?
It was in Gopeng Perak.
Gopeng Perak. Mm-hmm. And how would you characterize, like, a small town or a village?
Yeah,
or?
Gopeng is like a small town, about 40 or 30 minutes from Ipoh.
Mm-hmm. And Justin, where were you stationed?
I was in a small town called Putri Wangsa, but, you know, it's about 45 minutes north of JB. It was definitely part of the urban, suburban sprawl of JB, part of that corridor.
And Sarah?
I was in Muar for 2 years.
Okay. There's a great shifting of contexts here. From where you were in America and where you've ended up teaching English. There's a geographic difference, there's a racial difference, there's a class difference, all woven into this. But you're also, you're not here to do business or investment, you're actually teaching. So you have a position of influence in these places. So let's start with the basics of that thought process. Why did you choose to do this? And what were you hoping to get out of that experience?
For me, I came out of a religious studies and international relations undergraduate experience. Coming to Malaysia for me was a lot about understanding more about Malaysian culture. And I felt that the ETA program gave me the opportunity to exchange a certain skill set that schools had expressed interest in having. So to be able to observe certain cultural differences and religious ways of life while also being able to have a sense of purpose and being able to contribute to relationships.
For me, it was, you know, a way to live and work in another society, another culture through my interest in international relations. Definitely teaching English was kind of the vehicle for that experience, but I didn't have a particular training in English. I had volunteered to teach before. I think just as a percentage, it's maybe about 15% each year come through with a specific education background that may or may not be teaching English. But the other 85% come because they have a particular interest in this region or in the cultural exchange aspect of it.
And just for some context, you're from Northern California?
I'm from Northern California.
I mean, I'll echo what Alize and Justin said. I came over for similar reasons. The other thing that I'll add is that the Fulbright scholarship, which includes the ETA program, is often talked about in terms of its prestige. It's the flagship international education program of the Department of State in the U.S. But for me and for a number of other folks, an increasing number of folks in the program in Malaysia, it was also a scholarship of opportunity. I'm a first gen, so I was the first generation in my family to graduate from university. I come from a working class background, and so Fulbright for me was also an opportunity to go abroad and to experience a new culture and travel, which is not something that I had access to previously.
And it's very interesting too, because I think the three of you are situated differently in terms of the American social hierarchy. You said you came from a working class background. Where exactly?
I'm from Southern California, Long Beach.
I'm from a small town in Georgia.
Okay, all right, interesting. So, and you're basically coming here with those identities and experiences. Mm-hmm. The dynamics of privilege here is very different. How much of a conversation about privilege or thought process about it did you have before starting the program?
Well, it's now become like a major part of our orientation once they're in country. Because, yeah, definitely, as you're noting, like within the group, there's a huge spectrum of, a lot of issues of identity and how they play out, race, gender, class. And, yeah, and we make it a conversation within the cohort and within their communities where they're working mm-hmm. and how that plays out. Because not all ETAs will go through the program in the same way either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if they're coming with similar hopes and expectations for their time here, how they're situated in the community, that'll play out in vastly different ways.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the questions that you guys think about together in this process, like specific issues or specific concerns that you discuss in the preparation?
Yeah, I mean, so we talk a lot about a lot of different components of identity that are relevant to our ETAs. Race is a big one. A person's race or perceived race really impacts how they're viewed in these rural communities, and that can have a huge impact on day-to-day life. Gender is a big one, thinking about how people are perceived in that way, and the contrast between their contexts in the U.S. and what they're experiencing out in these communities.
Being Americans, you have your own experience of racial tensions and racial dynamics. To what extent is that useful or not at all to speak to the Malaysian context of racial tensions?
For me, I mean, it was really interesting because I grew up with a Muslim, an Islamic background in the States, and there is a certain level of racial tension between mm-hmm. Muslims or for Muslims, especially growing up in the American South, where mm-hmm. there isn't so much diversity. And so for me, coming to Malaysia, I thought that there were going to be a lot more, more of an opportunity to connect with my students on the basis of religion. And what I found was that it was an interesting dynamic to experience going from a minority Muslim to a Muslim in the dominant culture here. Mm-hmm. And that gave me access to a certain level of privilege here that I hadn't experienced in the States.
Do you feel that that privilege is problematic in a way? Being a part of, you know, the identity here that's largely politicized and that's largely used as a pretext to curb other people's freedoms, how was that experience?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. It gave me a certain level of perspective, especially because I was in a really diverse part of Malaysia in my mm-hmm. placement. There were about a third of my school was Chinese and a third was Indian, and then the rest were Malay and Orang Asli. Mm-hmm. And so what I found was that, interestingly, my adolescent experience was very similar to a lot of the experience of some of my minority students. Mm-hmm. And so I really was able to connect with a lot of the students who came out of Indian or Chinese backgrounds in that way, in that sort of political way.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things I'll say that I think is a good learning experience for ETAs in our program, I'm white. And so, you know, thinking about white privilege and what that means, out in these rural communities, definitely white privilege still exists in Malaysia, which is a big part of the racial landscape in the U.S. But one of the things that happens is a lot of our white ETAs for the first time will experience what it's like to be looked at for their race, will experience what it's like to be made the other on mm-hmm. the basis of race, which is not a common experience in the U.S. And I think that that can be a really insightful and interesting process for folks in terms of creating more awareness of what privilege actually looks like and feels like.
Yeah, I would echo that too. You know, I'm white. I have white privilege in the U.S. and I have white privilege in Malaysia, and it plays out in different ways. Yeah. And white privilege within the cohort too. You know, it plays out from that sometimes at the school level. Sometimes they project a lot of hopes onto me, like, "Oh, you're here now. Now the English level is just going to get better because you're just there."
Yeah.
And or the students will come up and say, "Sir, like, I like your skin color. I like the color of your eyes," mm-hmm. things like that. I mean, there are constructive ways in terms of engaging students if they mm-hmm. if they're bringing a level of excitement to it. That's where you can get them in the door and then have some of these conversations. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult, and it plays out in a lot of ways that are uncomfortable, that you don't feel like you deserve, the feeling of being a celebrity or something mm-hmm. in these communities mm-hmm. definitely is very strange sometimes mm-hmm. coming as, you know, whoever from your university where you are one in 10,000 people or something.
So that's interesting too, because white has certain meanings attached to it. And I assume from what you're sharing, it's like you said, the word hopes invested in that color, you know, in that you're going to usher some kind of progress in the school's, you know, learning culture when it comes to English or something.
Right. And to be honest, there's sometimes a divide too. There's also a little bit of a threat there. So there's the promise. They want like the real English, but sometimes culturally there can be a difference. Like people would see me and just assume that I had had sex, assume that I drank alcohol. Mm-hmm. That just comes with it as well. And so there is a little bit of a dichotomy between we really want you to improve the students' English, but we don't want them necessarily adapting all of your social values, your
things. And I mean, that brings up a lot of other kinds of complex issues too, right? You're talking about the sorts of American culture that makes it to Malaysia, the images that are produced, which tend to be dominated by whiteness and tend to be dominated by the upper class. And so folks in these communities have a very particular image of what American looks like and what it means to be an American woman, for example, that can lead to particular kinds of sexual harassment because they see these images of women that are hypersexualized, things like that, that don't necessarily have the wider cultural context. Mm-hmm. But beyond that as well, one of the other things that we see happen a lot is that, you know, white ETAs are more easily believed when they say that they're American. Mm-hmm. And there are all these sorts of assumptions like the ones that Justin mentioned as well, whereas ETAs of color maybe have to struggle a little bit more to be believed when they say that they're American. And so that's something that we do try to talk about within our program and that, you know, ETAs are constantly having to struggle with on a day-to-day basis.
Alize, you don't have that problem because you're not white, but you come with a Muslim name. So how do you navigate that complexity?
It's difficult. There's a lot of, my identities are very intersectional. I mean, being a Muslim woman who is American, you know, there's a certain confusion that comes with anybody who meets me and approaches me about how I could possibly both be Muslim and American because all of these certain ideas come with being American, like Sarah and Justin talked about. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a constant conversation. And it was a struggle at times to really bring that. And for me, I always tried to remember and recall sort of issues of post-colonialism in Malaysia when it came to questioning my ability to speak English as fluently or professionally as somebody else.
But I'm assuming it also came with certain advantages because being Muslim, you're already in a way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I was already in, but in other ways, my Muslim background is quite different from the Muslim background of those of other Malaysians here. I mean, the school of thought is different from sort of a Pakistani background. The way I dress, I don't wear a hijab or a tudung. And that is complex. And, and for many people, it was difficult to even accept that I might have been a Muslim of the same caliber or that is equal in my religious experience as somebody else.
You know, what we have for the first session of the discussion has been a sketch of how complex this transitioning of identities has been for the English teaching assistants here. But we'll take a pause now, but we'll return with the second part to go into more specifics, particularly about how these complexities run into ethical issues. But for now, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by Justin Galli, Alize Ahmad, and Sarah Townsend. They are all English teaching assistants here, having taught in small towns, rural areas. They're going to share their experiences and explore it with us a bit more. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by three guests. They're all English teaching assistants. They've had experience teaching English in largely small towns and rural areas. And they're going to share their experiences with us here today. They are Justin Galli, Alize Ahmad, and Sarah Townsend. And the first half of the show, we talked about, broadly speaking, the experience of being perceived a certain way, whether it's through your skin color, religious identity, or gender, and the complexities therein. But I want to touch on the issues of responsibility, particularly as teachers. And while your scope is English, I'm sure that it goes beyond that, especially as you've built relationships with your students and you share basically the same context as them after a while, and you're going to touch on other issues. What are the other issues that you've had to deal with other than just English throughout this time? Is it gender? Is it race? Share that.
the way that English is often taught in the schools that we're placed in is very corrective. It is very much the teacher is the bearer of knowledge and the students are the vessels to be filled and corrected. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
without maybe active participation or criticism back towards the teacher, which is something value that we come with.
Which is, yeah, that's part of the reason that that our program exists in these schools is to sort of balance that out a little bit, to do things that are a little more creative. You know, we're not necessarily here to teach the curriculum. We don't, a lot of our teachers don't keep the kids in their chairs. They do a lot of things outside of the classroom, a lot of extracurricular activities, a lot of things that sort of break the mold a little bit. And the point of that is to increase confidence in speaking English. And as a, you know, another thing that tends to happen is a lot of ETAs really invest in their students' confidence within themselves.
Yeah, so ETAs are required to do two, we call them English camps, but we really encourage them to kind of take it in any direction that they choose. And so we mentioned previously that a lot of them don't come in with a teaching background or an English pedagogy background. So we encourage them to do what is interesting to them, and so that can play out. And I mean, that can be music programs, that can be environmental awareness programs, that can be gender, you know, roles. Women's empowerment was a huge theme for workshops and programs that happened this year. We had people doing dance workshops. Mm-hmm. And so then you get into those issues you were mentioning before about, okay, each one of those fields carries a certain definition of ethics, and it can differ sometimes between the ETAs and their participant communities. So when an ETA says they want to do a girl power workshop, they have an idea in their head, and it may be vastly different from, you know, their a teacher or administrator that they're working with when they say that they want to do this program. And yeah, it can, it's an ethical and cultural negotiation. There are certain activities that won't be approved or that will be emphasized. And then there's the power dynamic, because ETAs, they know, is this program from the central government, from an American government. So there is also a little bit like, oh, I shouldn't mess around with whatever this ETA wants to do, because they were sent here and they're way above my position level, which is a really problematic space to occupy.
Depends on where they're placed. Can go ahead.
Depends on where they're placed.
Yeah.
Right. Or some of the people they work with would try to subsume them and say, no, you were assigned to help me. You're going to do exactly the programs that I value. But so when you have someone who's kind of going in full bore doing a program on women's empowerment or, you know, how to treat the environment, like I said, there's a lot of negotiation there.
But there's no real set process that you prescribe to everybody, saying that, oh, if you want to do a girl power training, you write a letter to A, you talk to B. No, there's no, everybody has to feel their own context.
Resources,
right?
We share stuff, but they create their own curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I would say how the program plays out at the school level really varies depending on the ETA and their particular framework, the school and the school's perception of the program, and then also the individual needs of the community. I would say as a program, as coordinators, we do try to emphasize, you know, listening and learning first and spending time on the ground, you know, feeling out the placement, getting to know people, building relationships, which for me personally, I will say as an ETA, when I was an ETA, that was very, very, very important to me. I really think that teaching, just like cultural exchange, is as much about learning and about going on the journey of learning together with the folks in your learning community, whether those be students or fellow teachers or administrators, as it is about bringing in pre-existing knowledge that you have and disseminating it. And I think that goes for developing programs as well, that having your ears open first is really, really vital. Mm-hmm. And it's also really vital when you're talking about navigating some of the things we talked about earlier, which includes all different kinds of privilege, racial privilege, or, you know, religious privilege, or simply the privilege of being from the U.S. and having an undergraduate degree or a master's degree.
Mm-hmm. Have your initiatives been met with resistance? Do you know of any cases when you do want to suggest something like an environmental awareness, like a dance weekend or something, that people do balk at the thought?
Yeah, it's certainly happened. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Any anecdotes? Anecdotes are welcome.
Sometimes with gender. Yeah. So we've had like girls' soccer programs get shut down because girls don't play soccer. We've had dance things kind of be rejected out of hand.
Yeah.
I mean, but the school has to have some power in this conversation dealing with their students. So we've had programs also shut down where the schools were, you know, thinking of safety concerns or how are you going to get all these kids to the jungle and back? And
Logistical concerns as well. You're speaking of the we here as if it's, there's an assumption of uniformity. I assume, you know, not everybody's from Northern California with, you know, your vibe and values, Justin. And are there issues within the ETAs, among ETAs themselves, about what exactly you know, the values that you should be espousing. You have a hands-off approach. You kind of steer it more actively. What are some of the internal discussions going on?
Yeah, I would definitely say there's variety, you know, sort of cohort to cohort, year to year, and then definitely within cohorts about how people approach this program. You know, from maybe Elise can speak to her experience, but from the coordinator perspective, one of the things that we really try to do is just stimulate critical discussion and reflection. And so we do have programs, you know, we have 100 ETAs, they're spread out across the country. We send out messaging and we meet with ETAs multiple times through the year. And we also bring them together on multiple different occasions, you know, orientation. We have something, a big statewide level meetings in April, and then a big mid-year program in the middle of the year. And a lot of the programming then is designed to, you know, help people go through the culture shock process in a way that is you know, healthy and encourages critical reflection and awareness. And then we have other types of programs that just encourage a lot of dialogue and reflection.
Yeah, I mean, something I would add on to that, all of those programs were extremely valuable for me this year. And something that I didn't quite expect coming into the ETA program was the diversity of the American population that is really represented within our cohort. I think, you know, beyond intercultural exchange, there was a lot of intracultural exchange within the cohort that I experienced this year. And, you know, meeting people who had never been friends with a Muslim before was part of the experience of being here as well, meeting Americans who had never left Iowa, and I've never been to Iowa, learning about Iowa, and them learning about the experience of being a Muslim girl in northern Georgia. Those kinds of conversations were valuable conversations as well. And of course, those had an influence and impact on the way we continue to take it into our communities and towards our perspectives on teaching.
An anecdote, sort of a pedestrian anecdote about a value that's maybe differ between ETAs when they come in, taking pictures with students. So that's something that, you know, within the Malaysian context, and especially within the Malaysian, like at the school level, pictures are everything. If you want to prove that you did a program, you have to send pictures with your report to your boss, mm-hmm. which is something that's kind of new for ETAs to think about, that they have to be documenting every single activity they do, or people kind of won't believe them or won't really understand what happened. But, you know, it plays out, and we all have Facebook, and a lot of ETAs make two Facebooks. They'll have their personal one from college, and they'll make an entirely new one to interact with the school. Mm-hmm. But a lot of ETAs also...
Which is for cultural reasons.
Right, for cultural reasons. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see all my pictures on my personal Facebook of me in college. Mm-hmm. Maybe a different hat that I was wearing at that time. But the ETAs who come in with a teaching background are like, absolutely, taking pictures of children and like sharing it on the internet? Absolutely not. Like in the mm-hmm, U.S. system, mm-hmm. that's illegal. And right. like, you cannot right. do that. Here, it's somewhat encouraged. But then you get in these aspects of what are you taking the pictures for? Who are you sending it to? And if you're using them on your personal Facebook, so that's to share with your community back mm-hmm, home. Mm-hmm. And there's a beauty in that, you know, that look, this is what I'm doing for my family and friends. These are the people that I'm interacting with. But there's also issues of like tokenization there. Is this just me with a picture with these students? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's like I'm on vacation. I'm taking a picture at a interesting site to look at.
Well, I'm curious too, because in Malaysia, politics and culture are so intertwined, right? There are no pretensions around that. Have you had to have conversations about contemporary politics, or is that taboo? Nowadays, people are talking about separate trolleys, right? Halal trolleys mm-hmm. for Muslim consumers. And to what extent does this echo even on the ground into everyday experience that you have with the kids?
It's interesting because, I mean, at its base level, this was started as a public diplomacy program between the mm-hmm. American and Malaysian governments. There's like an anecdote of President Obama and Prime Minister Najib meeting after they were both first elected and discussing about trying to repair this relationship between the two countries. That being said, in our program guidelines, it's actually specifically disallowed to talk about politics
at
the school mm-hmm. in education programs. Yeah. So then you have, if you speak about your personal experiences, I had conversations with people, certainly, but there was sort of a little bit of a taboo-ness mm-hmm. towards it. My personal perspective is that a lot of teachers, you know, they view themselves as civil servants working for the government.
Right.
So I was here in 2013 during the election, and maybe it's not an appropriate question to ask, but I asked people like, hey, who are you voting for? Yeah. Like, let's talk about this. Why? And they would be like, is that even a question? I'm confused. I work for the government. You realize that, right? I'm voting for the government. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll just add to that I think the conversation out, you know, this doesn't this hasn't been true in my experience in KL, but when I was living in Moir, it was certainly very gendered and also racialized. And I think that in general, you know, we had a conversation about this at our closing programming as well. Male ETAs have found that the male teachers and folks in their communities are more willing to talk about politics, especially in public places, than the women are.
And I would just add upon that is it's not just about governmental politics that we're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. A lot of the interesting discussions that I was able to have had to do with the politics of gender and politics of religion, which were similarly taboo, but there were more ways to sort of address those through our position, through teaching, through mm-hmm. being sort of a mentor to students mm-hmm. As part of this program. And some of those conversations ended up bringing a lot more to light about the Malaysian racial landscape, for example, issues related to gender than just simply having conversations about governmental politics.
Mm-hmm. What happens next? I mean, do you ever get a sense that, you know, you get this very enriching experience to travel across the world? You're met with all these very fascinating experiences that challenge your perception and you leave more enriched. Do you ever suspect that this might just be a touch and go experience, that this isn't really, benefiting the locals as much as it is you because of that asymmetry of power and privilege? How do you deal with that?
It's a great, great question. I think that there are a couple of different things that come up with that. First of all, in terms of, creating cross-cultural relationships, the Department of State gives out these scholarships because it's a people-to-people program, and they do expect the Fulbrighters who come back to the U.S. to talk about their experience and to share the knowledge with other folks in the U.S., lowering ignorance and increasing understanding of different regions of the world. So that's certainly something that I think our Fulbrighters tend to do, as well as maintaining relationships back here. So I think that that's a really big part of the program is it's the relationships, it's the exchange. It's not necessarily focused on teaching or on teaching practice. Again, only 15% of our mm-hmm. ETAs actually have a teaching background.
They're actively encouraged to be ambassadors for Malaysia for the rest of their life. They're supposed to take the experience
right.
forward.
Cool. Right. Yeah. And there certainly is an impact, hopefully, on the educational culture of these schools and the exchange. ETAs are encouraged to exchange, their knowledge and their activities with other teachers and to have that sort of impact. But I think one of the other things that is important about this program is that because it is a 10-month program, our ETAs are doing a deep culture dive. They're not doing a 2-week stint, a 3-week stint, mm-hmm. a 4-week stint. They really are living in these rural communities, which are in a lot of different ways very, very, very different culturally from the context that most of our ETAs come from. Mm-hmm. And it's very challenging. It's emotionally challenging. It's psychologically challenging. Most of our ETAs go through a really intense culture shock process. They come out of the other end better informed, and they come out of the other end really invested in their communities and experiences here. And I think that's something that people bring forward, even if it's not always in terms of the content of the dialogue that they'll have, just in terms of the impact that it has had on them.
Yeah, and not just carrying it forward, but I think a big part of the program for me was learning to really listen to the needs of my teachers and the needs of my school. So not just coming in with an agenda, but really formulating getting an understanding of what the students were in need of and really trying to lay some groundwork or forming relationships that would move forward beyond my 10-month experience, mm-hmm. things that really address, certain needs.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the continuity of programs that ETAs start or the sustainability of them can really, really vary, again, depending on the school and on the ETA. But one of the things that we talk about a lot is planting seeds mm-hmm. and planting seeds and planting seeds of curiosity about the rest of the world and, helping students to develop confidence, which when you do that, when you're helping to build that base, that's something that will carry forward for the students mm-hmm. as well.
I've had the opportunity to go back to my school where I was posted for mm-hmm. 2013. They had one other ETA after me, and then this year Johor was taken out of the program. So they haven't had an ETA. Yeah, in terms of a school culture, the general way English is taught and learned in that school, my impact was probably very, very small. Mm-hmm. But so again, we go back to the relationships. You know I had an impact with a lot of the students, yeah. a lot of the teachers who still keep in touch with me, who still ask me. You know, and we do a lot of volunteer programs in addition to our school. So some will volunteer locally at, you know, an NGO, or we've had people volunteer at orphanages. And they help out at other school programs. So I think in that kind of, you know, the surface level kind of stuff, they get around a lot. They work with a lot of students and have impact in those small, small ways.
And at the very least, it sounds like you're starting up friendships. And hopefully these friendships can flourish over time. And, you know, technology is around to stay in touch and stuff like that. I've never been to a lot of the places that ETAs have had to live in. I've never been to Gopeng.
Mm-hmm. Puchiwang says, near Puchiwang.
Yeah, I've never heard of those two places. So, I mean, everybody is like in their own sort of fixed orbits, you know, and it's just part of their work and life routine. And I'm pretty sure a lot of my friends haven't been to these towns too. What more are the places that, you know, I know ETAs are posted, especially in places like Sarawak, where it can get very, very rural. What are some of the things that Malaysians can learn from your experience? Because I think having a lot of the local political discourse in English has allowed you to follow more or less what's going on, how we frame rural Malaysia, small-town Malaysia, urban Malaysia. And you have different perspectives on these questions from your experiences. What would you like us to know from what you've gone through?
I mean, so I did a model United Nations program in Perak this year, and one of the things that really stuck out for me, and so if you're not familiar with the model United Nations format, is that the students are all given a country assignment. So they're the representative from Mexico, from Holland, mm-hmm. and they have to debate some kind of issue. Not really a debate, they're supposed to collaborate and produce a document. But so we discussed the crisis in Syria, which is not always talked about in public schools. The students had an understanding of it. But, you know, they were all given a certain country. They're on the Security Council. They're asked to just solve this issue. And, you know, there's big camps. There's the U.S.-led camp and there's the Russian-led camp. And, you know, Malaysia's on the Security Council. That's why we did it. But one of the things that stuck out for me most was there was a student who just came up to me in the middle of it. He's like, sir, you know, I'm like reading all these materials. I'm talking with my friends. I can't figure out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And that was the whole message of the entire program, was that it depends on what country you are, it depends on your history, your values, your perspectives, geopolitics. So that's a long-winded anecdote for the fact that I think one of the major things they can learn is that there's just another way of thinking about certain things. Mm-hmm. Whenever, like you're mentioning, you're in your little circle in KL and you maybe haven't been to Gopeng, to Muar. Similarly, some of these Malaysians and us, you know, in our circles coming out of our universities, which can sometimes be very circular in terms of the thinking, both for us and the communities. Just there's another way of thinking about things, and it's a constant negotiation whenever a task comes up. Like, how are we going to approach this? What are our values in doing this? And can we meet our priorities? And so I think a big power of the program is you're not always going to change those things, and then maybe that's sort of an attack if your goal is to change perspectives, change values. But there's a ton of overlap, right? And seeking to maximize the opportunities where there's overlap is, I think, where a lot of the benefit comes from.
This is a relatively shallow comment, but I'll just say that, you know, I think KL is a really different world from rural Malaysia, and there are a lot of big cultural differences. And I went through culture shock when I moved here, so I think that, I mean,
when you moved to KL from
when
Moir.
I moved to KL.
Yes. I just want to add, though, to that, Malaysia is in this developmental scramble, right? We want to be modern so much, and we have a very crude definition of modern sometimes, and we tend to look to small towns, rural Malaysia, with a lot of disdain and discomfort because they're not catching up, or they're not opening up as fast as Kuala Lumpur is, or as Subang is, or as Penang is, right? But I don't think that anxiety is really helpful, and I think there's a greater degree of openness in these so-called rural areas.
I do agree it's a red herring, the idea of openness versus non-openness. Mm-hmm. I don't think that dichotomy is real. I think there's cultural values in both sets, and they're engaging with the global order in their own way.
Yeah, I also think it's simplistic and harmful to look at, you know, certain areas of the country or certain cultural values as being behind, and to look at progress as some sort of, you know, linear narrative in which you've got, you know, one area of the country or one population of people that just isn't quite there yet, and they need to catch up to KL or they need to catch up to another population. And I think that is, you know, that is an attitude that, you know, I've encountered in my experience as an ETA, not just with KL culture being put on a pedestal, but with Western culture being put on a pedestal. And so I think having that sort of dichotomy and paradigm, you know, is a little bit uncomfortable, because I think it replicates these ideas that, you know, one of cultural superiority, which is problematic.
So adding to this conversation about an urban or rural divide is just it's not so much a dichotomy, it's a very textured mosaic, and it's very complex. And you get a state like Sarawak and a state like Kelantan and a state like Pahang all part of the same program. Mm-hmm. And are the same programs going to work in these three different states? Mm-hmm. Malaysia is an awesome country. There's so much to it. I've had the opportunity to travel to a lot of it during my time here. And it's just...
It's diverse.
It's diverse. Complex. It's a cliche, but it's so diverse. It really and it's is. So beautiful because yes. of that diversity.
I teach here too. I mean, among college students, and... it's of course of the privileged class, and they really absorb a lot of the rhetoric and logic of first world education, you know, the idea of going abroad. So they're coming up and telling me, you know, I want to go to Africa one day, I want to go to Burma one day and help out. And I think a lot of the things you mentioned today about what it means to teach, how do we really evaluate cultural differences, you know, how do we arrest the assumptions we have about cultural superiority, mm-hmm. can be of benefit mm-hmm. for Malaysians too, who are mm-hmm. thinking about extending their privileges elsewhere. But do you guys have Twitter accounts our listeners can reach you directly with?
Fulbright Malaysia has a Twitter.
Fulbright one?
Yeah,
okay.
It's mostly charming pictures. It's,
yeah. What's the handle?
@FulbrightMY.
At FulbrightMY. Yeah. Okay, cool.
I would just mention, I mean, if you're asking yep. for, like, you know, your students or something who are looking for advice, I think this conversation was really good at getting through some of the issues that come with this, but 100% is best decision of my life. It's a really good opportunity. Just go into it being genuine and mm-hmm. being critical and mm-hmm. understanding who you are and why you're in this community. What are your motivations and what are potentially the hopes or fears of the community that you're working with? And, mm-hmm. you know, try to approach it from an ethical standpoint.
Yeah. The only other thing I would add is if you're talking about taking privilege and wanting to leverage that in any sort of context, whether it be volunteering abroad or volunteering locally or doing any sort of work that works with communities, it's really important to be aware that, A, if you have privilege, be cognizant of it. B, you are probably not fully cognizant of what your privilege is and what it looks like. And to put that into practice, it's really important to just step down and listen and learn first before mm-hmm. you offer your services. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can just forward them to them. Thanks again, everybody, for sharing your insights so generously. And I've learned a lot in the course of this conversation. And once again, you've heard Justin Galli, Alize Ahmad, and Sarah Townsend. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.